signal processing theory and methods. SPTM is a committee in the Signal Processing Society, one of 14, and one of the largest committees. And the activities of SPTMTC is to cover areas such as statistical signal processing, adaptive signal processing, and nonlinear signal processing, and so on. So if you are interested, you're most welcome to visit our website, and if you are more, you can become an affiliate member. Affiliate members are those who express interest in the activities of the SPTMTC. And if you want to become a member, you can approach one of the members of the SPTMTC, and they may nominate you. Okay, today we have two exciting presentations by two experts, and the first one is Professor Ali Sayed from UCLA, and is known to you all, and he's going to talk about in-network processing, adaptation, and learning. So the session is split into two presentations, and after each presentation we have a few minutes for questions, and like to welcome you to be active and ask questions to the experts. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Abdelhak, and I would like to thank all of you for coming here. Unfortunately, I have another meeting right after this, so I apologize already in advance if I move a little bit faster than usual. Now, as you can imagine, SPTM is very broad. We cover lots of areas, lots of interesting areas in the general area of statistical signal processing, adaptation, learning, compressive sensing, and so forth. And the question was, you know, should we be broad but shallow, or should we pick some topic or one topic or two topics and go a little bit deeper? Okay, and through consultations with Vikram and with Abdelhak, we decided let's pick a topic and at least expose the attendees to what's going on in that area. And then if you are interested, of course, you can go and check the references and talk to us, and we'll be glad to give you more and more input into that. Now, I will be talking, and also Vikram will be talking. Vikram's talk also will complement my talk. Essentially, there are two general approaches that complement each other in this area. I'm very excited about this area, as you are going to see. It takes adaptation and learning to new levels. It adds new life to this very exciting area. I usually like to start my talk by showing this video. Okay, so I have a video here. Okay, look what you're going to see. Are you seeing something? I'm not seeing anything. Okay. So maybe somebody can help, because this was playing a while ago. Do you see something? It's not showing anything. This YouTube. So anyway, what you're going to see, okay, in words, you're going to see 300,000 birds. Okay. You're going to see, here it is, 300,000 birds moving up and down, to the left and to the right. Now you tell me, there is no big bird telling them what to do. There is no big bird telling these little birds in what direction you should go. 300,000 people in a stadium, will they hit each other or not? You turn on the fire alarm with 1,000 people, they are going to run over each other. How do the birds do that? That's incredible behavior. I would love to know what algorithms they use, what processing they use, what learning they use, how do they adjust, okay, to the neighbors around them. Okay, this is highly sophisticated behavior if you look at it. Okay, local processing, each bird is only processing information just around it to make decisions about how to go and where to go. And you have seen patterns of intelligent behavior like this in nature. We probably just ignored it. But the minute you start looking at it, you start trying to understand it, you are going to see how deep this behavior is and how difficult actually it is to reproduce that kind of behavior, okay? So I'm going to, this is a YouTube video, by the way, not my video, okay? So continuing. Okay. Now, birds are not the only example of intelligent behavior that you see there. Fish behave in a very, very smart manner. Here you have an example. This is a picture from National Geographic. Just look how they avoid a predator, right? They are moving together, almost in sync, almost in parallel. Suddenly they see an obstacle, they open up. in a very nice geometric shape, and then they close and continue their motion. Now you tell me, how did they achieve that kind of behavior? Is there a big fish telling them, look, you go here, you position yourself at this location, and you position yourself at that location? That's not what's happening. This kind of smart, intelligent, global behavior that you are seeing here is the result of highly localized information processing. So what kind of localized information processing can you do in order to generate that kind of sophisticated behavior? These are very, very important questions and very, very interesting questions. And if you look into the literature, of course, people have been studying this over many, many years in different disciplines, in biology, computer science, in animal behavior, in ecology. And I think now several colleagues in our field, including the speakers, we are also trying to understand as best as we can that kind of behavior and try to reproduce it. Not that we want to mimic animal behavior, but I think there is something we can learn from them to try to make our algorithms smarter, more robust, more interesting, active, and so forth. Okay? You have also seen birds fly in V formation. Birds also, by the way, if you look at the figure on the right, they also fly in U formation. And there are reasons for that, okay? Physical reasons for that. But here it is. The birds, before they launch into the sky, they don't decide that I'm going to be the first one and then you follow me to the right and you follow me to the left. They don't do flight planning beforehand, right? This behavior is the result of highly localized, intelligent information processing that results in this kind of very global rational behavior. How do they do it? Very interesting behavior, right? So the more you look into it, the more you get excited about it. This is another example of some work which appeared about almost 2 years ago, received some press. I have a video to show you here. What you're going to see, let's hope the video works this time. Okay, they put some bacteria, I mean lots of bacteria, because these are tiny organisms, right, in a dish with, I believe, with some oxygen and liquid in it, and then they put these tiny, tiny motors, okay, these tiny MEMS-sized devices. You can hardly see them. Now, we all expect the bacteria to be moving left and right randomly in Brownian motion. Now, when you observe this under a microscope, this is what you see, this kind of behavior. You see these two tiny devices moving almost coherently in a certain direction. So what's happening here, okay? Are the bacteria, I don't know, I'm just asking questions, right? Are the bacteria coordinating their behavior, resulting in this kind of highly coordinated behavior and rotation in a single direction, right? That's an interesting kind of behavior. So what's happening at the agent level, at the highly localized level, okay? So these are very interesting questions that come up when you start observing this kind of behavior in nature. Okay, so if you look at all these examples, fish, birds, bacteria, bees, okay, what you are going to see is that while each individual agent in its own right is not sophisticated, when we put them together, their cooperation, their interaction at that highly localized level leads to the complex patterns of behavior. Okay, people have observed this for years, of course. Okay, the question now for us, I'm going to show it on the next slide, but this is the conclusion of these examples that you see here, examples of interactions among sophisticated agents lead to sophisticated complex behavior. Of course, when I say agents, I don't mean agents that can do nothing, right? These agents have some cognition in them, okay? It may be minimal, okay? But when they put them to work together, it leads to that kind of interesting behavior. So can our algorithms, right, in statistical signal processing, in adaptation, in learning, in cognition, in machine learning, can our mimic that kind of intelligence where you get lots from little? Okay, that's the main question that we would like. For example, important questions that you may consider: how and why organized behavior arises? What kind of local interactions you need to have to generate a certain kind of sophisticated behavior you might be interested in at the global level? What kind of topology should exist between the agents so that they share information in such a way that results in the kind of coordinated behavior that you would like to result? Okay, how much should information be quantized? Should these elements share information at a very high quantization level, or is lower quantization level enough? I'm sure that when the fish are moving and they see a shark, they don't share detailed information like the speed of the shark, the weight of the shark, the color of the shark, the direction. They probably just, perhaps, I don't know, I'm just guessing here, they just say shark, right? And then everybody gets into a mode that tries to avoid the shark, right? This is one example of quantization. How much information quantization you need such that that kind of behavior appears. And the last question is very important. You know, if you think about it, all these examples that I showed you, they are not static networks. These nodes are moving all the time. Your neighbor, your neighbors 5 minutes from now. The connections are changing all the time. These are highly mobile networks, and mobility has influences learning and influences cognition, okay, and the other way around also. The more cognitive you are about your environment, that may also influence how you move in your environment, okay? So these questions are tied together, and these are important to address. Now, from the perspective of our committee or from the perspective of signal processing in general, there are many, many techniques you can apply to address problems like this. Vikram is going to talk also about some additional techniques, which I should have listed here. So you have distributed processing, of course, is at the heart of all of this. Filtering, estimation, adaptation, learning, real-time processing, game theoretic methods, statistical methods. There are techniques that you can use to try to model that kind of behavior. And like I said, people in other areas have noticed these behaviors, and they have exploited them in many different ways. You even see animations of coordinated behaviors in movies, right? People in graphic design and computer science have generated animations that you see that reproduce this kind of behavior. Here we are interested, of course, in a different level of processing, in different kinds of questions. How do we develop algorithms that can generate that kind of high-level intelligence, right, from highly localized, simple interactions at the local level? Okay, this is the high-level question we have in mind. Now, of course, I don't have time here to go through algorithms. In research group, we have developed a large family of algorithms can model and address learning and adaptation under such conditions when you have mobile networks and interactions at local levels. I'm not going to discuss the algorithms yet for the sake of brevity, but I would like to show you some simulations, examples, two examples of the things you are able to do with the algorithm. And the interesting thing, the same class of algorithms you can apply to model bee behavior, bird behavior, bacteria behavior, fish behavior. It tells you that there is something there. Okay. For example, what you are going to see in the first example, a group of fish, they don't know where it is, okay? They need to find where the food is. They are going to walk together, coordinate together, find where the food is, and move in that direction. And then suddenly, a shark appears. So they have to be aware of their environment. They have to also track where the shark is. So food, let's say, is a fixed objective. Shark is a moving objective. They have to track it and respond to it. So as you are going to see in this simulation, this is not the kind of application where you would like the some sort of consensus. Because a fish that's closer has to behave in a different manner than a fish that's far away from the shark and closer to the food. This is the kind of example where the nodes need to have some individual ability to adapt on their own, in addition to trying to learn from their neighbors. It's not enough to only focus and try to reach consensus with your neighbors. You have to be able to adapt and learn and assess the situation based on your own assessment. So here you have, this is just high definitions of what adaptive or cognitive networks are. I think you already get the idea, nodes interacting with each other and learning from each other. I'm going to skip that. And this is an example. You see the food is that right, on the right, up there you have the food, and the fish try to move towards the food. You know, this is a highly adaptive network, okay? Going to see it from the start down here. They move together towards the food through localized interactions. And then a predator is present in the environment. They react to it. And then they regroup. You know, this is using an adaptive algorithm of the kind I showed you before. Nothing more. Nothing more. Highly localized interaction resulting and able to mimic the kind of behavior you see in nature. Okay? So this is one example. The next example, you are going to see two networks working against each other. And also it mimics the kind of behavior you find in nature. You are going to see a group of sharks trying to attack a group of fish. Now, this in nature, they encircle the fish. Okay, so you have a network of sharks coordinating with each other so that they know the fish, and a network of fish coordinating with each other so that they know where the food is, where the sharks are, and what they should do. That's what you are going to see in the next example. Okay, so here it is, the fish moving and then the sharks appear. This also mimics very well the kind of behavior. This is adaptation and level. And this is the kind of thing where, like I said, you cannot expect these fish to reach agreement with everybody else, right? They have to save themselves, okay? They do their best when they can, in coordination with their neighbors. But when it comes time to decide for your life, then you have to take some decisions on your own. Okay? So these are two examples that I wanted to show about how adaptation and learning works in high dynamic mobile environments involving multiple agents. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. I think this gives an overview, okay, of what the area is. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Are you willing to take up a few questions?
Yeah,
okay. So if there are questions from
you have any questions,
the audience,
I'd be glad to answer.
Any
them.
Comments? None?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ali. Thanks. Okay. Now I would like to ask Vikram Krishnamurti, also working in SPTM and very active in adaptive signal processing. Thank you very much, Ali. He's going to talk about a few areas, a few emerging. I would like to remind you that this expert session is not a summary of what's happening here at ICASP. I'm sure you'll find that there are other areas that that are also important, but we're trying to focus here on a few important areas, and we can't cover everything. So please do appreciate that, and we'd like to have an appreciation of what we're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Abdulhak. So I only have two slides here. In the first slide, I just want to give an incomplete list of several important areas based on submissions in ICAST this year and, I guess, extrapolation of what might be interesting. So this is an incomplete list. It's obviously formed by talking to some few colleagues, and I apologize if any areas are left out. But so these are six areas we've listed here. The first is signal processing on dynamic graphs, and as many of you know, that is actually a fairly important area at the moment. People are looking at consensus formation, information flows, games, social networks, and it's quite multidisciplinary as well. If you think about it, not only does it affect signal processing, but I guess if you're looking at things like social networks, you're trying to model how society functions in terms of some of these analyses and algorithms. Then another area which is also of enormous popularity in particularly our SPTM society is high-dimensional signal processing and sparsity. I mean, if you look at this year's ICAST, there's been an enormous number of papers in that area. From a mathematical point of view, many of these results deal with this very seminal idea of concentration of measure theorems, and compressed sensing is one such example. Many of you would have known that there are special sessions in ICAST on that. The Transaction and Signal Processing publishes numerous papers in that area. Also, there are two special issues of journals selected topics in signal processing. Again, it's multidisciplinary, involves people in computer science, machine learning, and also biomedical imaging uses that. Another area which is also of significant importance coming from signal processing is financial time series. Traditionally, people in mathematical finance do things in continuous time. They use things like stochastic calculus and so on. But there is also a big community doing things in discrete time, and those are people who do financial time series. Then, of course, there's a smart grid, and most of us know that that's something with a lot of potential. There's distributed sensing, decision-making, and control, and that's really what Ali was talking about in his part of the talk. And in my next slide, I want to give a few more ideas behind that. So you can think of these as cognitive systems, the ability of a system to use feedback to reconfigure its behavior. And I want to talk a bit more about that later. And again, this is very multidisciplinary. There are people in economics who have done some very serious work in this area and also in other areas. And finally, the signal processing in the life sciences. So it comes all the way down from small molecules, how you can simulate the behavior of small molecules and how drugs bind to small molecules, all the way up to large-scale biomedical imaging and instrumentation. I just found this little snippet from looking at the Nature website, nature.com. Nature is one of the highest impact journals in biology. And as they talk here, so actually companies like Pfizer and Novartis, which are drug companies, are investing billions of dollars in high-speed stochastic simulation at the molecular level to see how drugs bind to molecules. And they use Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. So that's something which I guess people in signal processing do quite a bit of. And you might be interested in the same snippet that MATLAB is also developing a symbiology tool which allows people to analyze chemical pathways and also estimate parameters and sensitivity of these pathways. So it's actually a very active area of enormous significance to signal processing. Okay, so that's a very incomplete list of some areas of importance. I now want to, in my last slide, simply focus on the area of distributed sensing, which I guess was something which adds on to what Ali said in his talk. So let's just kind of look at the big picture here once again. So in standard signal processing, we do things open loop. We have a sensor measuring signal and noise, and then we want to process that noisy measurement to estimate the underlying signal. Now, you can think of a philosophical advance in that where you use some form of feedback where the estimate of your signal is fed back to the sensor so that the sensor can reconfigure its behavior in real time. One such example could be a distributed system where the picture on the right-hand side, where you have multiple agents, sensors or agents, each with their own individual control unit, and each guy wants to reconfigure its behavior to do something. So, I mean, one can think of a thought experiment where perhaps each sensor is monitoring some sort of target. If too many sensors turn on, then they're wasting battery life, so they don't all want to turn on. If too few sensors turn on, there's too few measurements, and then if you do a data fusion, then you have a very high variance. So how does a sensor decide without talking to other sensors should it turn on or off? Okay. Keeping in mind that it's not completely capitalistic. If it was completely capitalistic, it would say, to hell with everybody else, I'm going to sleep and not turn on because I preserve my battery life. It's not completely socialistic because then it would simply turn on all the time, burn out and die, and it wouldn't be very useful. So without talking to other people, by using rationality, the ability to predict what other sensors are going to do, how does it decide when it switches on and when does it switch off? Now, what economists do, and really I'm talking in this slide from an economics viewpoint, what an economist would do to analyze such a problem is they would introduce the assumption that each agent is rational. We say cognitive and rationality, and cognitive actually are very similar in some sense. So rationality means the following, that if I get a measurement, I can predict from that what other agents are going to do, because all I have is a measurement. So I'm going to use my measurement to predict what other people are going to do. I'm going to act based on that. And other people know that I'm going to react to a measurement in the way I'm going to do. So they know what I'm doing. They know that I know that they know what I'm doing, and so on ad infinitum. And that really results in something called an equilibrium. The different types of equilibria behavior, Nash equilibria, correlated equilibria, and so on. But the main idea being that here is a system on the right-hand side where eventually, if things were done correctly, individual agents like fish or sharks or whatever can reconfigure the behavior with minimal communication to achieve a common goal. Okay. So there one can pose here, and all three are really which people in microeconomics have studied in great detail in the last 10, 15 years. The first question can be, how can agents autonomously manage the behavior? And that's really, I guess, the question I posed. Now, you can think of an offshoot of that as, if each agent does something simple, how can you ensure that the global behavior is complex or rational? Okay. And again, I just want to point you out to one seminal paper written by Sergio Hart, who's a really famous economist. And if you look at Econometrica 2005, he has a 50-page paper which gives you an amazing perspective of how, if individual agents in an economy do something very simple, like run a simple adaptive filter, the global performance is remarkable. That eventually every agent achieves a consensus, not just consensus in estimation, but consensus in action. That is, all agents eventually act with the same decision policy. So they have some remarkable tools in microeconomics how to come up with some of them. And the tool they use here is really game theory as an analysis methodology. They also have game theoretic learning algorithms which further refine how agents can act. The second question one can pose is, in the standard paradigm in signal processing, typically when one is looking at agents and sensors, each sensor has measurements and it updates estimates based on those measurements. Now you can think of a further refinement of that where agents not only get measurements, but they look at actions of other agents. So they look and see, what have other people done? How can I learn from what other people have done? If you think about that, an action really is some sense a quantization of an observation, because an agent gets an observation, the agent processes that maybe in a rational way by a Bayes rule, and then picks an action. If you simply look at the action, it's in some sense a quantized version of the observation. You've lost some information. So how can agents learn from other agents? And if you do this, do things actually work out? Well, there's this really classical example which has been studied in great detail in economics that I just want to quickly mention, that it results in something called a rational herd. And so just to give you the example of that, in 1995, two management gurus, Tracy and Wiersma, wrote a book. The book had fairly poor reviews. So what they did was they secretly bought 50,000 copies of their own book. Overnight, it becomes a bestseller in New York Times. People say, this is a bestseller, it must be good, and everybody started buying it. So here are rational people buying the book because they're following the actions of other agents. You see, if they had the observation as opposed to the action, the observation would be who bought the book. And if they knew it was the authors buying the book, they wouldn't have bought it. So the moment you act purely based on observing actions of other agents, you can show in many cases, eventually all agents end up forming something called a rational herd. They all eventually mimic everybody else, and they throw away their actual observations. So there's been some very interesting work done in this area in economics, and if you look at, for example, the book by Shamley, published by Cambridge University Press on rational herds, it gives you a very interesting perspective on how you can model complicated systems and how they perform. Now, this also has, obviously, applications in sensors where you might put a malicious agent which deliberately acts in a particular way, and it makes every other agent eventually act in that way. So you can think of applications in several areas. The third question which one, again, can pose, again, it's driven by people in microeconomics, is how do local decisions affect global decision-making? So in the little picture at the bottom of the slide, I have on the left-hand side a bunch of red and green dots. And it's actually just a very straightforward example of a sequential change detection problem. So let's assume we have a bunch of agents. Each agent gets an observation of a particular thing. And they can't relay their observation to the next guy. What they can relay is either they detect a change, they say it's changed, or it's not changed. So maybe green means it hasn't changed, red means it's changed. Okay, so the first guy says maybe it's changed, the second guy says not changed, and so on. Each guy is making a local decision. If you could only take these local decisions, how does a global decision maker decide to say that there is a change and stop? That's a standard quickest time sequential detection problem. It turns out that the moment you base your global decision on local actions, things go catastrophically wrong. So you can show that the optimal policy in this case is a double threshold. And if you look at it, it's highly counterintuitive. So that's on the right-hand side at the bottom. So on the x-axis is a probability, posterior probability, this is a Bayesian detection problem, of change. And the and the vertical axis is the decision each agent takes. So you can see that as the belief, as your posterior distribution that a change has happened goes larger, you declare a change. But amazingly, when it gets even larger, you say, no, there's no change. The reason is you have a discontinuity in your Bayesian update because you're basing it based on actions of the previous agents. And then, of course, further on, you say there is a change. So these multiple threshold policies are quite very counterintuitive, because why would you change your decision if you get more sure about what you're measuring? And it's something, again, which has been studied in great detail by people in economics who really try to model complex phenomena in terms of local and global decisions and how decisions affect each other. So those are three things I just thought I'd mention in terms of applications of some of the methodologies Ali Syed posed. The simple unifying theme behind all of this is, how does local behavior affect global behavior? Or if you're like a biologist, you can view it as saying, if I have the structure which is local, how can I predict the function which is global? And that's what biologists do. They have the structure of different small molecules. They want to say, if these molecules function in a cell, how can I predict what they actually do, given the structure? And it's really related to this. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Vikram. So you can see that interdisciplinarity has become very important in our research today. And this is what came out of these two talks. So are there any comments or questions from the audience? I'm sorry this session is very short, but we'll will allow some questions. Please, Lang.
No, I was just wondering, with the had an example of the case of malicious agent upsetting global behavior.
Yeah, so I could give you another example because I deal quite a bit in mathematical finance, and many of you would know today that almost 40% of all trading is done by computers. Wall Street runs now at a millisecond timescale, and humans cannot buy and sell at a millisecond timescale. They're not quick enough. So a lot of the buying and selling is done by computer programs. Now, many people know that. So if you were to design a computer program which deliberately, for example, started buying euros, the value of a euro would go up. Now, if your computer program was running from a reputable agency like Goldman Sachs, I hope nobody from Goldman Sachs is here, but anyway, you would make people believe because of a reputation that the euro is really going up. All these other computer programs are custom trained to follow what Goldman Sachs is doing, and they would start buying. And then you would suddenly sell. It's called a speculative currency attack. You make billions, and before the other guys can react, that's it, you're out of the market and you've made a lot of money. So these sort of things are widely used in economics. They're called speculative currency attacks. And so if you look at, for example, Hart's paper, he talks about those in great detail. He talks about Bayesian and non-Bayesian versions of such games.
So time scale is important.
Yeah, it is. These are all dynamical systems. So none of this is static. We're talking about dynamical systems and how you can control behavior.
Maybe another question before we close the session, goes on until 12:15. So one question or a comment. If this is not the case, I would like to thank you again to have attended the session and see you around. Thank you very much.